It is official. Iran has won the war. The U.S. has surrendered. That's the main takeaway from the Iran deal this week. Meanwhile, Ukraine has hit Moscow hard. What does this mean for the future of that conflict? And a new report in the UK spreads a bright light on a dark subject: mass rape gangs. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World.
But I'll tell you this, what Mr. Trump has done here is going to plague him from the very beginning to the end of his tenure in office. That is a fact, that, and you wait and see if it doesn't happen that way, unless there's a big change in what he's doing. He has disgraced Netanyahu, and it's just a catastrophe that it's hard to even describe.
That was Mr. Flurry back in January of 2025, right when Donald Trump had come into office. And as he said there, this attitude is going to plague him. It's going to lead to all these terrible consequences throughout this time of office. And we just saw that with Iran, and I think we're going to see this a whole lot more now in the months ahead. President Trump has basically declared that Iran has won the war. He's given them the victory, and he's admitted Iran has a tool that they can continue to use to punish the world, to hold the world to ransom. I mean, starting this up with just a bit of an overview here with Donald Trump, they've come along, he signed this peace deal, and he said we had to sign it because, well, the global economy was going to go into meltdown, we were going to have recession anyway, it's the smart thing to do. This looks to be a disaster. And maybe Donald Trump will reverse course. I think there's already some signs today that things could fall apart. But right now, this is pretty disastrous. I want to step back and look at this in the context of Bible prophecy, because this has completely underpinned everything that we've talked about, what is going on here in Iran right from day one of the war. And before day one of the war, while Donald Trump was preparing to attack Iran, and while it looked like he was going to bomb Iran back into the Stone Age, there was talk of regime change. They were going to get rid of the mullahs. And we said right from the start, yeah, there might be some effect on Iran from this, but he's not going to deal with the problem. And we took you to Daniel chapter 11, starting in verse 40, that talks about this clash between the king of the north and the king of the south. And the king of the north is this Holy Roman Empire, this European power that is rising right now, that we see every week in all of these headlines with Germany rearming, Europe coming together. It's the king of the north that is ultimately going to deal with Iran, this aggressive, pushy king of the south, not the United States of America. So that means Donald Trump isn't going to completely deal with the problem. He may deal Iran some setbacks, but he is not going to destroy them. And a few months ago, that analysis didn't look all that promising. Daniel 11 and verse 40 seemed like, well, maybe it's wrong. And this morning, you can see where we go from here to Daniel 11 and verse 40. We can go there very smoothly, very quickly. I mean, we don't know all the twists and turns it may take, but there's a very clear path from where we are now to that prophecy. Because Donald Trump has told Iran, yeah, you can hold the global economy to ransom for the Strait of Hormuz. We are not willing to do what it takes to open that strait. So you can use that for leverage. And even there's some unconfirmed reports just as we start recording this show that Iran has said, nope, we're not happy with how the deal is being implemented. We're closing the straits again. Melanie Phillips wrote today that rather than ushering in an economic nirvana, Trump has given Iran the ability to take the world economy permanently hostage. After the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding, 60-day negotiation period, there's nothing to stop it continuing its protection racket on the Strait of Hormuz by charging ships for selective safe transit. As U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded, Iran now retains the ability to close the strait whenever it chooses, leaving the Islamic Republic with the capacity to trigger significant economic disruption at any time. I mean, that's the big point that Melanie Phillips drives home in this article, and it's a really good one, a really important one. This isn't over. She says Trump's surrender has produced a crisis not just for Israel, but America as well. And we could add to that to Europe, to the for the Holy Roman Empire, for the King of the North. It's handed them a tool that they can use whenever they want. Something they can use to push at Europe, to push at the world. And so you see how this could very easily go from here to Daniel 11 is a clash that revolves around Jerusalem, what's being described at this time of the end in verse 40. And so you can see as part of that clash then, Iran has control over this sea gate. Daniel 11 brings out Iran having control over the Red Sea as well, forming alliances with Libya and Egypt and Ethiopia. And you know, they go after other sea gates. And you see how we're going to get there from here very easily. Saudi Arabia, some of the other countries, they've been looking for ways to bypass the Strait of Hormuz. Saudi Arabia has this pipeline leading to the Red Sea. They're probably going to try and do more so that they can bypass Hormuz. And Iran doubles down on its Seagate strategy, builds up its link so it can go after the Red Sea too. So it's not just Hormuz. And they push against Europe. And Europe says, well, America won't deal with the problem. They didn't last time. They just keep capitulating. We're going to go in hard. We're going to do it. We're going to obliterate Iran. That is where this is leading. And it brings in other prophecies as well. J.D. Vance, yesterday, I think it was, he was saying that Israel is not being smart right now. He told Israel, look, you've got one ally. Everyone else hates you. You've got one ally, the United States in America of America. He said, if I were in the cabinet of the Israeli government, I might not be attacking the only powerful ally that I have anywhere left in the entire world. You know, Israel, you're vulnerable. You've got to do what we tell you. And here's a disastrous deal for you. But if we say go along with it, we're your only ally. And you can see people in Israel and the Israeli leadership agreeing to an extent, saying, well, yeah, OK, we do just have one ally. And it doesn't look like we can trust him. We need to reach out. We need to look for other allies. And, well, Germany has been much more friendly to us than the rest of Europe throughout this conflict. And we've already got a strong relationship with Germany. Israel was selling Arrow 3 missiles to Germany, even while they needed those to intercept Iranian missiles raining down on their cities. Well, let's build on this relationship. Let's try and work on our relationship with Europe so that we're not dependent on the United States. So they can't present us with a fait accompli and say, sign this or else. Another news story, now you're seeing Europe all getting ready to go in and patrol Hormuz. Germany sending a couple of ships to the Red Sea, a minesweeper. Saw another headline just a few minutes ago that the Netherlands have announced they're going to send in a ship. France and Britain are talking about doing this. So we've had a story that looked like it ran in the opposite direction from Bible prophecy initially. And now we are... And the results are right in line with Bible prophecy. And I think I'm looking forward to seeing the Key of David. I've just seen the title for next week, in a week's time, that is going to be all about exactly this. So I'd say keep an eye out for that Key of David. I mean, this show is all about putting the emphasis on the Bible, showing you that this is a now book that... Maybe some things don't make sense in there to you, but you can rely on what it says. Maybe your way of thinking is, well, actually, this seems like it's going to make sense, or the way to do it. The Bible says actually go this way. Do it the Bible's way. I've done that. There's things in the Bible. There's commands that, okay, it doesn't make sense to me, but the Bible says do it. I'll do it. And you will have great success. And here we have a prophecy. The Bible says it's going this way. Looks like it's going the other way. And it turns right around. You can build your life on the Bible and on God's revealed truth. And that's not the only takeaway from this. And we might also talk about, you know, when it comes to how do you produce peace? Well, that's something that's bound up with the gospel. How, you know, the gospel is about God bringing peace to the world. Is this how you bring peace? Anyway, before we maybe get into all of that, let's bring in Mihailo Zekic, our Middle East correspondent, and just get a bit more of an overview of what is in the deal and what we saw this week.
Well, in a nutshell, the deal was signed virtually by Vice President Vance on Monday. President Trump signed it in person Wednesday at the Palace of Versailles while he was in France. Interesting location I'll get to later. But the actual points, there's 14 points in the memorandum. And to summarize it all, it looks startlingly similar to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the 2015 Barack Obama deal that Mr. Fleury has put so much emphasis on, how this is the worst foreign policy disaster America's ever accomplished. This is authored by the devil. And I think this deal, from what we can tell, is outdoing even that. The first point, point one of 14, says that all fronts of the war, including Lebanon, are all terminated. In other words, Israel is no longer allowed to attack Hezbollah. Israel is not mentioned by name anywhere in the document. Israel, not only were they sidelined from negotiations, they didn't even know what was in the memorandum, reportedly, until we, the public, found out. So the U.S. was essentially sending Israel a diktat, you could say. The sixth point includes a $300 billion reconstruction fund for Iran. We've talked a bit earlier about how that may never materialize, but the very fact that President Trump is publicly saying these are his terms, that this is what he's offering in the negotiation table, at least is a severe humiliation for the United States. Point seven says that the U.S. agrees to terminate all sanctions against Iran, including United Nations Security Council sanctions, including international atomic energy sanctions, including unilateral U.S. sanctions. Let's unpackage that for a little bit. Last year, Europe announced they were triggering the snapback sanctions from that 2015 deal. I guess you could say the faintest silver linings in that deal, it put international sanctions on Iran, on its weapons trade. Now, President Trump says, we're not even going to be following those. Those are null and void. He put a lot of unilateral sanctions in 2018 when he left the deal, when he left the Barack Obama's deal, saying it was a bad deal, we're going to do what's right. He's removing his own sanctions. The International Atomic Energy, that has nothing to do with the current war. That has to do with Iran's nuclear program. The only reason the energy agency would sanction Iran is because of its nuclear program, which is apparently the whole reason we got into this war in the first place. Those are all null and void now as well. The actual nuclear negotiations itself is supposed to be conducted within a two-month period. This deal doesn't even touch on that. And then points 10 and 11 talk about waivers for Iran exporting its own oil, unfreezing Iranian assets, exactly the same thing that the JCPOA did. And we've talked about on previous programs on this show on the nuclear negotiations themselves. From what details we can gather, are mirroring the JCPOA in so many ways, the sunset clauses. Only now, it seems as if President Trump is giving Iran even more, at least offering them even more in a public forum for the whole world to see, than even Barack Obama was bold enough to do. Ben Caspit, an Israeli journalist writing for the Israeli paper Mariv, said the JCPOA would look, quote, perfect in comparison. Now, he's an Israeli leftist journalist that's using it to attack Prime Minister Netanyahu. But on that point, I hate to admit it, but I agree with him. Amit Segal, he's a prominent right-wing journalist. He posted on X a quote from Henry Kissinger saying, "It may be dangerous to be America's enemy, but to be America's friend is fatal." That's the view, both on the left and on the right, in Israel, that they're having of this deal. Some more details from President Trump's trip to France. You mentioned that he was attacking Israel. He specifically said that Israel's bombing campaign against Hezbollah is killing the deal, that they're killing too many people, that all these talking points that we've gotten used to when Joe Biden was in the White House, when Barack Obama was in the White House. And he even suggested that Syria, his new buddy, the Al-Qaeda-affiliated president, would do a better job of taking over Hezbollah, and he wants him to go finish the job. In short, between the deal, between all these comments, between all these threats, like with J.D. Vance here mentioning, everybody in his administration is all of a sudden sounding like Barack Obama, giving the same talking points, threatening the same punishments, which is, to say the least, somebody who claims to be the most pro-Israel president ever who entered into this war arm in arm with Netanyahu, saying, "I share his views completely. We're going to go into Iran and give unconditional surrender. We're going to finish the job." To have such a dramatic 180 and such a mind change, may I even dare say, is dramatic to say the least.
And that is where Melanie Phillips picked up on the Qatar link, which I think you were writing on this morning, not saying for sure that Donald Trump has been bought off, but, and I tend to think not, but I do think it's a question that's worth asking when you see such a dramatic turnaround. I mean, what is the picture there?
Well, yesterday, White House Communications Director Stephen Chung announced the current Air Force One plane had just completed its last flight. This is the same plane that's been carrying presidents since George H.W. Bush in the 90s. And while he didn't specify what was going to happen next, for anybody that was following us since last year, the next Air Force One plane is a $400 million Boeing jet that Qatar had gifted to the president. It's so lavish, some people have called it a flying palace. And that's going to serve as the next Air Force One until the president finishes his term. It will be donated immediately to President Trump's presidential library in Miami. Back then, a lot of people were saying this looks all but a bribe, and it still looks like a bribe. There have been more details since then of some activities Qatar has been doing, like having back-channel negotiations with Iran, offering to be their mouthpiece in the president's ear. In May, the president announced that Qatar has agreed to invest or accomplish business deals worth over $1 trillion. They're still doing business with the United States. They're still keeping contact with Iran. We've seen before how they were the mouthpiece for Hamas. They let Hamas be headquartered in Doha. They were giving Hamas protection from the United States, protection from Israel. And it looks like, at the very least, there's room open for them to be doing the same kind of thing with Iran.
So a big part of the reason why Donald Trump has done this is the effect on the U.S. economy. There's political issues with the midterm elections coming up, even division within the MAGA base, where there is a more isolationist wing of MAGA. So maybe we can bring Andrew Miller, our U.S. correspondent, into the discussion to give his thoughts and comments on this deal.
The economic angle is definitely an important one, because this deal is an unmitigated defeat for the United States. During President Trump's rise to power, he spent a lot of time lampooning Barack Obama's Iran deal as one of the worst deals in American history. And now he's made his own deal just like it. So you really do have to step back and ask, like, well, what changed in his thinking that this deal that he previously criticized so much is now something that he's saying is a great thing? And he kind of said the quiet part out loud during his trip to France to sign this deal in Versailles, where he noted that just this week, the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve hit its lowest level since 1983, 340 million barrels. and then further noted that we were probably only about 4 weeks away from it being completely empty, which he said would have been an economic catastrophe. So he was saying these things, kind of trying to make it look like he saved the nation by getting this deal done in time to stop an energy crisis. But reading between the lines here, it's like he's basically admitting that we were just a few weeks away from an energy crisis, and he had to sign this deal to stop that. So in that context, you see what a bad defeat this was, that President Trump knew the Obama deal was bad. He actually went to war with Iran to stop it from getting a nuclear weapon, bombed Iranian nuclear facilities, for a while was talking about unconditional surrender and absolute regime change in Tehran, and then did an abrupt U-turn and brought back the Obama deal he'd previously criticized so heavily in order to stop this energy crisis, because Iran had control of the Strait of Hormuz. It had shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Global oil supplies rely on the Strait of Hormuz. And America didn't have the military will to open it by force. So, yes, this deal may kick the can down the road, so to speak, and giving America some breathing room to, like, restock up its strategic oil reserve. But it's also demonstrated that Iran had the power to basically hold the U.S. to ransom and get back the old Obama deal it liked so much. And that's something Iran's definitely going to remember in the future, that they went to war with the world's premier military superpower and won because of their control of this strategic oil choke point. And we know from Bible prophecy that they're going to be using these strategic sea gates again. Deuteronomy 28, a verse we quote often on this program, talks about America's enemies besieging it and all its gates. On a global scale, a gate is a sea gate, like the Panama Canal or the Straits of Gibraltar or the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the Suez Canal. And so Iran's seen how powerfully they were able to use Suez. And so you can bet their next move is going to be taking actions in Egypt and in Eritrea and in Djibouti and in Yemen and in Ethiopia to make sure they control those other sea gates in the Middle East as well.
And it's important, I think, to stop and emphasize this failure to produce peace, whether it's for economic reasons, the reasons for giving in to Iran, all of this, because this is right at the heart of the end time events. It's at the heart of what Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, traveling around the world as an unofficial ambassador for world peace. And it is one of the big, massive lessons God wants us to learn from the events that we're living through, that mankind does not know the way to peace. And that fundamentally, peace does not come from compromise. And no matter what the Pope may say, he's been pushing for this and celebrating the deal. That's not the Bible's way of peace. You know, okay, Iran wants to wipe us off the map. We don't want to be wiped off the map. Let's meet halfway. Iran can wipe half of Israel off the map. You know, that's not the way of peace. And any compromise you make with a country like Iran, you're just helping them. They're just going to take whatever you give them, use that to destroy you. Mr. Armstrong talked about this a lot. Here's just a few clips from a World Tomorrow telecast that he gave.
Many people have called me an unofficial ambassador for world peace. And I had a press meeting in this hotel in another room a couple of three days ago, and some of the press reporters there asked me why I couldn't just bring world peace right away. Well, no, I didn't come here to just wave a magic wand and hocus pocus, you've got world peace. I can't produce peace like that. It takes something to cause peace. And there had to be a cause for all of the troubles. There is a cause and a reason why we don't have peace. And we will never have peace until we eliminate the cause of trouble, the cause of wars, the cause of violence, the cause of terrorism. Why do we have things like that? Now, I have said you can sum up the whole cause of all of the trouble in two words, human nature. But how did we get human nature, and where did human nature come from, and how did it start? I said before a press conference that peace is not going to come until this world learns a lesson. We do not live the way that would produce peace. If we lived according to the right way of life, the way of loving your neighbor as much as you love yourself, we would all have peace. But people don't live like that. The problems in this world have become so great that no man in any government can solve them. I've talked to heads of government, to kings and prime ministers and presidents and heads of government all over the world. And I had lunch even just this noon with your president. And they are capable men who run governments all over the world. But no human being is capable of solving all of these problems. Now, why? This world has been allotted 6,000 years of human experience to go on and learn the lesson that selfishness and trying to get from other people and competition and strife is not the way toward peace and is not the way toward happiness and is not the way to have prosperity and the good things that could be produced out of the earth, because all material things come out of the earth.
Peace comes from a way of life. And as long as nations are living the get way of life, as long as they're looking to take, you're not going to have peace. And signing a piece of paper with Iran won't bring peace. If they're still trying to destroy Israel and destroy the United States, the little Satan and the great Satan as they see it, you need to change attitudes. You need to change selfishness. You need to get away from that attitude of get. And man doesn't know how to do that. And that is what God is going to bring. That is the peace that he is going to bring. We've had a lot of other content on this important story this week. Trumpet executive editor Stephen Flurry, he's talked about this a lot on his Trumpet Daily Show. If you want more, I'd really encourage you to go and listen to that. And we've got an article going up today as well by Mr. Blondeau with an interesting comparison to the parallels, but with the Treaty of Versailles and the flaws in that treaty, where that once again tried to create a peace where people still hated each other and completely failed. So you can get all of that on our website, thetrumpet.com. So thank you very much for bringing us that important Middle Eastern story, Mihailo. We'll go back to Andrew now to look at his top story from the English-speaking world.
Yeah, last week on this program, we talked quite a bit about the riots in Belfast that broke out after a Muslim jihadi from Sudan attempted to behead an Irish man in the streets of Belfast. And then particularly transitioning into just kind of this prophesied sickness in Britain's mind, a sickness prophesied in Hosea 5 that inflicts both the modern-day nation of Israel and the nation of Great Britain, where you're unable to identify the forces trying to destroy you. In that program, we talked quite a bit more about Muslim knife crime in Britain, and we didn't really get into the grooming gangs that have taken over many British cities. Although this week will be a good chance to get into that topic, because there's just been a new report released by British MP Rupert Lowe attempting to quantify the grooming gang problem. This has been something that people have been known has been going on for a long time. Cities like Rotherham, it's in Britain. It's about 13% Muslim population, largely Pakistani. And they've had a rape problem for years, where you've got basically these gangs of Pakistani men luring British girls into their homes, raping them, passing them around. And then when they get arrested, the government, in order to not stir up Islamophobia, really downplays the ethnic and religious aspects of these gangs. So it's been an open secret in Britain for years that this has been a problem in Rotterdam and other cities. This new report by Rupert Lowe attempts to put a number on it. They're, because the government won't give official statistics, they're estimating about 250,000 girls raped over the course of a couple decades. So divide 250,000 by 20, and it's a little over 1,000 per year, which, based on other news reports, seems like a rough ballpark estimation. And then, so this report's designed to just really give some publicity to something that has been suppressed in the British media to the point where you can even get in legal trouble for Facebook and other posts trying to expose this. So I feel like this is one of the main positives of the Rupert Lowe report, is that whether or not the 250,000 figure is exact, it is at least a highlighting in official news channels this problem of, you've got these gangs of Pakistani men in Rotterdam and other cities that are targeting British girls and not being held legally to account nearly to the extent they should be. This plays into the story we were talking about last week with the knife crime, where you know that there's like five specific ethnicities in Britain: Somalis, Iranians, Afghans, Sudanese, that are only about 0.6% of Britain's overall population, but likely committing as high as 6% of the knife crime. So making them 10 times more likely than the average Briton to commit a crime like the crime that happened in Belfast. And this is largely something that the UK Home Office is complicit for, in the fact that in the past 3 years, the Home Office has accepted something to the tune of 180,000 asylum seekers from around the world, mostly the Islamic world, 9,000 of them specifically from Sudan after the Sudanese civil war broke out. And due to a pretty controversial fast-track program, about 90% of these asylum seekers have been approved. Many of them without even a personal interview. And so you get cases like the man who tried to commit the beheading in Belfast. He's from Sudan. He speaks Arabic. He doesn't speak English. He doesn't speak Gaelic. I don't even know if he could have had a personal interview, given that he doesn't speak the language. Worked as a police officer in Khartoum. And presumably, Khartoum being a very Islamic society, you have to be pretty Islamist to get on the police force there. And then was just let into the United Kingdom as an asylum seeker without being vetted at all. And so it just stands to logic, and this shows like the sickness and the thinking, that if you're going to let immigrants into your country, like I said, you want to vet them, you want to look at their background, you want to find out, like, do they speak the language, are they a radical Islamist, any connections with Al-Qaeda, have they worked for the police force in Khartoum, do they even understand, like, biblical law against rape and sexual assault, or are these things that are normal in the places they come from? Because if you just let thousands of people in unvetted, yeah, you're going to have beheading attempts. You're going to have a knife wave crime. And you're going to have grooming gangs like the ones that are popping up across Britain. Now, the government's saying that, like, you point out these facts, you're Islamophobic, so that you can't do that. And so we have to let these immigrants from Khartoum and Afghanistan and other places into the country without so much as an interview. And if girls get raped, so be it. This is a very serious topic, a topic that I feel like things like this Rupert Lowe report will shed some public awareness on, because that verse in Hosea about like the sickness in Ephraim's thinking and the sickness in Judah's thinking, it's specifically in the context, it says when Ephraim saw its sickness, it went to the Assyrians, but they couldn't heal them. So that verse itself does indicate that at some point along the line, there's going to be some public awareness that something's wrong. And that would be a great time to repent and turn back to God. The verse indicates that Britain's probably not going to do that. Instead, they're going to go to Germany for help and find out that they can't fix this problem on their own. But before that happens, there does have to be at least some sort of public awareness that there is a sickness in Britain and in Israel. Mr. Gerald Flory has explicitly identified the sickness in Israel as the peace process. This idea that you can negotiate with the Palestinians for peace, when really it's actually the peace process that's what's destroying Israel. And that verse lumping Ephraim and Israel together indicates that Britain has a similar problem. And I definitely feel that like this, the way Britain has responded to this grooming gang crisis so far, you do have the same amount of just really illogical, nationally self-destructive thinking that you've been dealing with in Israel and even to a lesser extent, the United States. I feel like the United States has been a little ahead of the curve in recognizing the dangers of illegal immigration and Islamic terrorism. But then Donald Trump turns around and does something like sign this Iran deal, showing that there's even a sickness in his thinking as well.
Yeah, and it's a sickness, really, that you see in this. I've written a bit on the Rotherham deal. I went through, I think it was the Jay report, which was a government-backed report into it several years ago. It just exposes sickness at all kinds of levels of society. A lot of these girls that were preyed upon were in the care system. The fact that there's so many children being cared for by the state is in itself a symptom of a breakdown of family. Like, there's just so much parents that are, you know, a lot of these girls, their parents are drug addicts or they're in prison. They can't take care of their children. And so they're in this care system. That system is then completely overwhelmed. You have other situations where the parents are just otherwise completely unconcerned with what their kids are doing. You had situations where foster parents or authorities at the hospitals, authorities in the care homes, when they heard these teenage girls, sometimes just 13, 14 years old, were going out and even putting the best possible spin on it. Maybe they weren't aware of the rapes, but I think they were. But even if they weren't, they were kind of saying, well, you know, that's their lifestyle choice. We can't judge them. If we think that it's wrong that they're sleeping with older Muslim men, you know, that's their decision. They're 13 years old. They can decide to do that. So, I mean, that, which is just an insane decision for these authority figures in their lives to be making. You have these situations where then the police were releasing people back to the rapists. I think in some cases, even the rapists themselves were serving in the police force. You had the local government covering the story up because, as they said it, they didn't want to rock the multicultural boat or the racial boat. They didn't want to offend people. They didn't want to cause divisions. So they covered it all up. You had social workers that were kind of present at forced marriages. Some of the details, I think that was in the Lowe report, and I wasn't aware of that before. So many failures, so many children sacrificed on the altars of multiculturalism. And this has been, you know, in some ways it's been reported. Like, it's been on the front page of the Times newspaper. There have been official government reports. There was a BBC drama. And then nothing happens. And then, you know, there's no change. Some of these people that were originally arrested when this very first came to light, they're being released. Some of them aren't even being deported. They're just being released back into Britain to do the same thing. Just no change, no reply, no, very little in terms of how do we address this? And now it's to the point that all of these mainstream sources, including the BBC, had reports and including government reports saying and acknowledging this is a Muslim problem. I mean, the way they put it, it's Asian grooming gangs, which I think unfairly maligns lots of Asians whose backgrounds have nothing to do with this. It's a Pakistani Muslim problem predominantly. But they've admitted, okay, this is a problem. They wouldn't put it quite as plainly as I've just done, but they admit that it's a problem with people from a certain background, that this kind of gang abuse is predominantly coming from people from that background. Even sources like the BBC admitted that. And now, somehow, they're still trying to say, well, if you say that, that's racist. And they're still trying to deny it and just throw all of that under the bus. Like, we admitted that this was allowed to go on because of political correctness, and we're still embracing political correctness. And I think this is why there's so much frustration and anger in Britain, is this. In some ways, like, this is a dramatic new light from this report. But in other ways, like, we have had the facts. Like, a lot of it compiles a lot of facts that have just been in the mainstream press that we knew about and still did nothing. There's a lot in this report that really is not new, that everyone could have known about before it was published. So, yeah, like, how do you deal with this? A lot of people have that frustration, and it shows a lot about the sickness of your society. I mean, Isaiah chapter 1 talks about that. The whole head is sick. And if your society cannot protect its own daughters from being preyed upon, and also, I mean, we've been saying daughters. I think it was the Jay report. Some of these earlier reports said that teenage boys are likely being preyed upon at the same rate, but due to the social stigma around that, they're less likely to come forwards. And of course, you know, there's no pregnancy that would be happening there. So that's probably an underreported side of this story as well. So it's own children being attacked by foreigners, and we won't do anything. I mean, I mentioned these failed peace processes. This is designed to show us, well, mankind cannot produce peace. He doesn't know the way to peace. I mean, we don't know the way to run our countries. I'm sure a lot of people could do a whole lot better than the current government is and authorities are dealing with this issue. But we've made a complete mess of our society. And the solution is to get back to the Bible and to let that clean our societies up. Did you have any other stories from the English-speaking world, Andrew?
Yeah, I've got three other quick stories that are along the lines of these same trends we've been talking about. The first one highlighting, again, America's retreat from global leadership. We've already talked about America trying to pull out of the Middle East in order to, like, placate Iran to keep oil flowing through Hormuz. Also this week, Defense Secretary or Secretary of War Pete Hegseth gave a speech talking about how the United States is reviewing its troop deployments in Europe, specifically saying that it wants to draw down the number of American troops in Europe and let Germany and the European Union take more responsibility for securing the European continent. The first Secretary General of NATO famously said that the entire purpose of the alliance was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, and the Germans down. And now, more and more, it seems like the Trump administration definitely wants the Americans to get out and the Germans to get up, which will likely result in Germany letting some of the Russians in to places like Ukraine and Belarus and other places in Eastern Europe. So that's a significant trend. Another trend highlighting just kind of like this sickness in America's and thinking shows that the violence over illegal immigration here in the United States is a very real threat, a threat that's being specifically promoted by the Antifa Alliance here in the United States. President Trump has declared Antifa a terrorist group after an Antifa-linked radical assassinated Charlie Kirk. And in its part of its efforts to crack down on Antifa, they've arrested 12 people and indicted a couple more who were involved in the protest in Minneapolis, Minnesota several months ago, particularly trying to stop law enforcement officers from arresting and deporting illegal immigrants. So showing that just, yeah, the crime and the drug cartels that come in through illegal immigration is a threat to the United States. But also you've got domestic American citizens that are joining Marxist groups like Antifa to fight against those law enforcement officers who would even try to stop people from coming here illegally. And so that's another big threat we're dealing with in America. And then one final story I kind of found particularly interesting is we're heading into next month, the 250th anniversary of the United States. And so this is, you'd think, is normally a time for quite a bit of American patriotism. They just did a poll finding that actually only about 50% of those polled, which is presumably a representative sample that can be applied to all Americans, are actually proud to be American, which is an all-time low statistic. Just 15 years ago, there was like 80-something percent of Americans were proud to be American. So now that's down from like 83% to only 51%. And it does look like one of the major reasons for this decline is not people who are ashamed of the sins of America and not people who are embarrassed by America's failure to live up to its own principles, but people who are actually ashamed of biblical principles themselves. They did a related poll. And I found this fascinating, that said that about 83% of Americans agree with the statement that America was founded on the idea that all people are created equal and are endowed by their creator with life, with unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's in the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. It's kind of hard to deny that that was America's founding ideal. However, even though most Americans agree with that statement, very few, not only like 15% of Americans, claim that America was founded on like an Anglo-Saxon love for liberty. So they like the idea that all people are endowed by their creator with unalienable rights, but they're embarrassed by the idea that America was founded on Anglo-Saxon values, which, without making this go too long, I feel like this exposes a pretty glaring ignorance in the average American about their history and about their culture. Because that idea that, well, Thomas Jefferson wrote, all Americans have unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that was a direct paraphrase from something John Locke wrote about Americans having unalienable rights to life, liberty, and property. But John Locke himself, well, one, he was ethnically English, ethnically Anglo-Saxon. And two, specifically, he was a Whig politician involved in the Puritan movement, critiquing ideas in the Roman Catholic Church. Because like no one in the medieval Roman Catholic Church believed that people had an unalienable right to liberty. They believe that people had, the unalienable right to obey the Pope. So this idea that America was founded on, I mean, it was definitely came from the Puritan movement of the English church. And so once you do, as these polls suggest people are doing, like you cling to the idea that unalienable rights exist, but you say that God's unimportant, you say that Christianity is unimportant, you say that your national heritage is unimportant. It's like, well, it was God, Christianity, and your national heritage that led people to embrace that idea. So I feel like there's like a cognitive dissonance here where people are still clinging to the idea that people have unalienable rights, but rejecting the religion and rejecting the culture that produced that idea. Which logically, if you continue along that path, it's not going to be very long before you even reject the idea that people have unalienable rights. And so I just bring it up because I feel like it highlights some things we've been talking about just like this self-loathing that a lot of multiculturalists have, that like, oh, we don't want to lionize our own culture, so we need to be respectful of the ideas that the Pakistanis have about sex and consent, which are not compatible with what the Bible says about sex and consent. And this idea that you're rejecting the Christian religion is having symptoms. You're rejecting the Bible is having symptoms that are spilling over into other areas of society, even if the average American hasn't diagnosed the root cause yet of why all these problems are occurring.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Well, the Ukraine war, as we talked about recently, has dragged on now for longer than World War One. It's become a steady background of world news, something that's quite easy to tune out, despite the fact that there is a war going on right now in Europe. But this week, there were some pretty dramatic events, a dramatic attack from Ukraine on Moscow. So to hear about that, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. Moscow, the capital of Russia, was blanketed in thick black smoke for much of yesterday as a result of Ukraine carrying out its largest drone assault yet on the city. And this was a massive attack. Russian state media said that their air defenses downed 992 drones, as well as 4 long-range cruise missiles and 10 aerial bombs. Now, those figures have not been independently verified, and it's likely that Russia is inflating those numbers to make their air defenses sound more effective than they actually are. But whatever the true number of Russian interceptions was, it's clear from video footage taken in Moscow that many Ukrainian weapons punched through the defenses and hit targets in Moscow. The most notable one was the Moscow oil refinery. That is the largest refinery in the city, supplying about 40% of the capital's gasoline and about half of its diesel fuel. And it's just stunning to look at the footage of the strikes on this refinery, because you see these enormous plumes of black smoke. And as the hours went by, it just kept on burning, and an acrid haze formed across large parts of Moscow. And some residents even uploaded footage of what you could call oil rain falling from the sky down onto their cars and their houses. So there's a serious environmental crisis there. And it's yet another big blow to Russian energy exports. You know, energy, it is the lifeblood of the Russian economy. And since Ukraine keeps on hitting more and more of Russia's energy infrastructure, it's taking a real toll on Russia's ability to produce and export it to the world. And this attack also triggered airport shutdowns across the city and all kinds of heightened security measures. So it was a serious strike by Ukraine, and it was a big humiliation for Russia and for Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's more evidence that this war has not gone the way Putin and the rest of Russia expected. At the start of the war, back in early 2022, they said that it would be an easy win, take just a few days or weeks, since many Ukrainians wanted Russia to take over. But it turns out that that wasn't the case. And here we are, 4.5 years later, as you said, longer than the span of World War I. And Russia is at a point where it's failing to make any meaningful gains on the battlefield. For months now, they've made no significant progress there. And now on top of that, they've got this humiliating attack on their capital city that they're having to clean up. So it is a setback for Russia. But that doesn't mean that this is the end of Russia's war. Putin remains fiercely determined to conquer this nation. This could even be something that prompts him to intensify Russian aggression. He still has millions more men that he could deploy and factories that are churning out more and more missiles and drones and other weapons. He also has, of course, the world's largest nuclear arsenal that so far has not been used. So Putin remains fiercely, unwaveringly determined in this war, and he is not yet out of options. And biblical prophecy actually gives us some insight into his determination. There's a passage of Bible prophecy, it's Ezekiel chapter 38, and actually going into chapter 39 as well. And trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury says that these chapters are about a certain Russian leader in the modern era, and it's a leader who will soon be the head of a vast Asian bloc of nations in the near future. And Mr. Fleury says that the Russian man being described in these passages is none other than Vladimir Putin. So we can't say for sure how Ukraine strikes deeper and deeper into Russian territory will ultimately go, or how exactly all the details of this war will play out. But Mr. Fleury says that one thing we can be sure of is that Putin will not be pushed out of power. And in fact, in the years ahead, he'll become even more powerful. And he'll soon be leading that pan-Asian army far larger than his current forces, because it will include the forces of several other Asian nations. Mr. Fleury has a booklet all about these Bible passages and his understanding of them. It's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia. That booklet actually has a fair amount to say about Russia's quest to conquer Ukraine in particular. It says that Ukraine is, quote, the linchpin of Putin's goal of a renewed imperial Russia. So for anyone who would like to know more about Russia's war on Ukraine and understand it in the context of prophecy, that booklet would be an invaluable read. Once again, it's called The Prophesied Prince of Russia.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. And do you see any other takeaways, perhaps for non-Russian countries, or just the development of weapons, the state of war, from this attack? Because it does seem like another level of capability than we've seen from Ukraine so far.
To me, this is just more evidence that things that we thought were true 10 years ago about the dominance of fighter jets and nations with a very advanced, technologically advanced military being kind of untouchable by weaker nations. We used to think that that meant a military like America's and like Russia's was untouchable. But now we see, because of developments with drone warfare in particular and AI that is powering so much of the drone warfare, really the battlefield is being leveled in a way that makes weaker nations far more capable of attacking someone like Russia, like the US, who were long thought to be, you know, kind of disproportionately powerful and in some ways untouchable. So I think that this definitely has very sobering implications. Technology is changing with a pace that is just stunning to see. And it means that a lot of what we thought was true no longer is.
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Did you have any other stories from the Asia region to bring us this week?
Yes, well, we just spoke about a big Russian humiliation, but Putin also enjoyed a significant victory this week in the Republic of Georgia. So this is another former Soviet nation, just as Ukraine is a former Soviet nation. Those are the main places that Putin wants to regain control over. And on Tuesday, Putin had a Russian-born Kremlin bureaucrat installed as the prime minister of South Ossetia. South Ossetia was one of the two provinces that Putin declared as independent after his war on Georgia back in 2008. So he has really, he has already had de facto control over this region ever since 2008. But for all those years, there was a law that prevented Russians from being the rulers of South Ossetia. But last month, Putin had that rule changed, and now here he is just a month later, and he has already installed a man named Murat Kambalov as prime minister. And Kambalov is Russian-born, as I said, and he's a Kremlin veteran. He's held numerous positions over the years in various Russian federal government bodies. So to have this man ruling South Ossetia shows just how tight Putin's grip over this region has become. Most of the world still protests what Vladimir Putin did in Georgia back in 2008, and they say South Ossetia is still Georgian. But despite all of that, Putin now has this Kremlin insider in power there. And this is just one more sign of Putin's determination to rebuild the old Soviet space and to pull more and more territories and more people under his control. And then I have one final story here about China setting up a digital payment system to compete with the US dollar. Basically, China is upgrading its digital yuan, upgrading it to an interest-bearing digital deposit account. The Chinese hope that this will increase adoption of the digital yuan at home and also expand its use in international trade. And this comes just a day after Russia and Iran took another big step to connect their banking payment networks. So none of these moves on their own will dethrone the US dollar, but each one of them is another crack in the foundations of the dollar-centric global financial system that has really underpinned American power for decades. And we're seeing more and more of these moves by American adversaries. So the pressure against the dollar continues to build.
Thank you, Jeremiah. Well, that brings us to Europe. The main story I wanted to focus on for Europe this week is a pretty shocking new poll from YouGov. Just a few months ago, it was big news and would be our main story here when the Alternative for Deutschland, this far-right party, was the most popular party by just 1 or 2 percentage points. You know, maybe they were on 22%, and the Christian Democratic Union, the conservative mainstream party, maybe 21, 20%. Well, the latest poll put the AfD on 29% and the Christian Democratic parties on 20%, a 9-point lead. This is quite the turnaround for what was once a minority party, now just dominating everything. And I should say the conservative parties were in second place there. All the other parties were just much smaller. So they've got about a third of the support, while no one else can really break through that one-fifth level of support. Now, mainstream parties have so far refused to work with the Alternative for Deutschland, but it's getting to the point that in some locations, that may not be possible. Saxony-Anhalt, they're due to hold some statewide elections in September, and the AfD is polling at over 40%. Now, in German politics, if parties fail to cross a 5% threshold, they don't make it into the state parliament or the national parliament if it's a national election. So if the AfD is comfortably above 40%, depending on where other parties fall and if they fall short of that 5% threshold, they may be able to govern alone. They may not even need a coalition. And you'll have them in completely in charge of a German state. Now, even if they fall short, even if they don't quite manage to cross that 50% threshold, you get to the point where it is impossible to exclude the extreme parties from power. You have the Alternative for Deutschland. You know, this is a party that is far right. This is a party where its leaders have praised the achievements of its soldiers in the Second World War, that is a party that fundamentally calls for an overhaul of how Germany views its history, a party that rehabilitates Nazi slogans. So you've got them on the far right. Then you've also got the Left Party, and they're the modern successor to East Germany's Communist Party. And I think, if anything, they're further left than the AfD is far right. They're an extreme party as well. Combined, those two should very comfortably win more than 50% in Saxony-Anhalt. So if they win a majority of the seats, you cannot govern without at least one of them. Somebody has to compromise with the extremes at that point, or you have a minority coalition. But again, if they don't work with one of those two parties, they can't get anything done. Now, why is this? Part of it is a desensitizing to these extreme parties, these Nazi sympathetic parties that used to be shunned in German politics. That's not the case anymore. And part of it is the desperation of German people. I mean, we were talking earlier in Trumpet World about the grooming gang report in Britain. And you do have similar problems in Germany that mainstream parties won't talk about. You also have major economic problems now, as the country's economics miracle that was driven by manufacturing starts to struggle, starts to go into decline. I mean, Germany, this is typically, traditionally, Germany, a very high trust society, a society where you used to be able to get on trains and never have to show your ticket because they could take it for granted that most people would go and buy one. I think even now, traveling around Germany, honesty boxes, I think, are more common just about anywhere than anywhere else I've ever traveled. And then you bring in a bunch of migrants into this situation, and you have the sexual assault, you have the thefts, you have the ending of this society. Of course, people want solutions. And the mainstream parties won't even talk about the problems, let alone address them. And so they're going to parties like the AfD. And they're choosing these parties that, okay, well, they'll look past some of the extreme rhetoric. Mr. Flurry wrote in the August Trumpet print magazine, "The rise of this extreme party is just one sign of a German society in trouble." He said that the rise of the Nazi spirit in Europe is sobering. It certainly shows how the climate is ripe for the rise of a strongman, or the rise of this strongman. We're expecting the rise of a strongman in Europe. And all of these problems that have been inflicted by the mainstream parties, they've caused problems in society. You see that with the rise of the far right, and it's going to cause Germans to embrace this strong German leader. And you can see more on that in Mr. Flurry's article, "Nazism Rises Again in Germany." Well, as usual, we also have a whole bunch of stories that we can run down quickly about Europe's militarization. Germany and Japan are arming again 80 years after World War II. That was the take of the New York Times last weekend, talking about these two powers coming together, these two powers both having, they put it, a growing wariness of America. I think you could put it much stronger than that. And these two powers both together building up their military. That's a really important trend to watch. We also had a whole set of articles this week talking about the gold rush atmosphere at Germany's military air trade show, the International Aerospace Exhibition in Berlin. I mean, I don't think that is actually purely a military trade show, but that was where the money was. I mean, there's certainly a military capability, military side of things, but it's called the ILA. And, you know, there's the whole aerospace industry represented here. But the military, that was where things were really booming. Deutsche Welle is the one that called it, talked about the gold rush atmosphere that was happening there. And then another story, related to this, that the chief of the German Luftwaffe, the Air Force, said that Germany is ready to fight Russia tonight. You know, they're ready to go. And of course, they're still building up, but the Telegraph commented, "The Luftwaffe's chief's comments are among the strongest from a German military leader in years and reflect a fundamental shift in Berlin towards rearmament and a greater role in European security." So that is rising very quickly. Poland, Lithuania, and France, they're right now conducting military exercises, joint exercises with about 10,000 personnel that is focused on defending Poland. And particularly that gap between Lithuania and Russia's militarized enclave of Kaliningrad. And Finland removed the ban on nuclear weapons being stationed in their country. So lots of signs of all of Europe militarizing. Keep watching that. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We've mentioned a few different articles. If I would just recommend one book at the end of this show, it would be The King of the South book. We talked about how we've seen that prophecy fulfilled with what went on in Israel or in Gaza or in Iran with the signing of Donald Trump's deal at Versailles. The King of the South is rising. That book explains what is next and where it is leading. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send that to you. We will be back on Wednesday. The show goes out every Wednesday and Friday generally. So we'll be back with our regular show on Wednesday, with then our week in review next Friday. If you'd like to send in any questions, any comments, you can email us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. Thank you to all of our panelists. Thank you to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.